This is Fresh Air. We've all heard about the man in Kuwait who was sentenced to 15 years for wearing a Saddam Hussein t-shirt. Is that typical of the post-war trials in Kuwait? Ken Roth, deputy director of Human Rights Watch, returned this week from a 9-day trip to Kuwait. He observed the trials of men and women accused of collaborating with the Iraqis. He investigated charges that Kuwaiti security forces are using violence and torture against non-citizens. And he looked into the situation of refugees and displaced persons. On Tuesday, he'll testify before Congress. We invited him to share his findings with us, starting with the trials.
Well, what has been surprising is that there have been no really big fish to emerge out of the collaborator trials so far. This is nothing like the Nuremberg trials, for example, where mass murderers or torturers are being put on trial. In part, that probably is due to the fact that many of those responsible for the most serious abuses were Iraqis who simply fled back to Iraq during the ground war and were able to escape Kuwaiti jurisdiction. Those people who are being tried range from, on the one hand, people who are being accused of informing to the Iraqi authorities, a very serious charge since informing often could lead to torture and death for those informed upon. They also, in perhaps the most interesting case so far, include people who are accused of helping write and run a newspaper, Al Nida, put out by the occupation authorities during several months of the occupation.
Now, there have been, I believe, 22 people accused of collaborating with this newspaper of the Iraqi occupation. What are some of the issues that this trial raises in terms of how due process is being handled in the Kuwaiti trials?
Well, the Al Nida trial is significant because it is the first trial in which detailed evidence has actually been presented. A number of the trials after the first day, which was ridiculous by its summary nature. But after that initial day, the courts have been quite careful to appoint attorneys and then adjourn the trial so that the attorneys could prepare before later evidence was introduced. The Al Nida trial was the first to get to the second stage in which evidence was actually presented. And the nature of that evidence was quite troubling in my view. The lead defendant, the only Kuwaiti on trial, a Kuwaiti woman, had quite a bit of direct testimony presented against her. But for the other 21 of the 22 defendants on trial, the main issue that they were raising, the main defense, was one of coercion. They would say, look, we were forced to participate on Al Nida by the occupation authorities, and we risked torture or death at Iraqi hands. We had no choice. And the only evidence that the Kuwaiti prosecutor has presented to rebut that defense of coercion has been evidence presented through a police officer that supposedly was reported to him by an unidentified secret source. And despite defense efforts to learn the attributes of the secret force or to identify him, the police officer simply refused even to say whether the source had been in Kuwait throughout the occupation, whether he or she had worked for the newspaper for the entire period. It led me to wonder whether there even was a secret source or whether this so-called source was simply an agglomeration of various pieces of evidence of questionable reliability that the prosecutor had been able to piece together.
Is the verdict in yet for these 22 who are accused of collaborating?
No. The summations have been made, and so it appears that all that is left is for the five-judge panel to render its decision, and that decision is now awaited on June 15th.
Now, I believe some people who have been arrested and are facing charges are saying that they were forced under pressure or through torture to confess to crimes or to collaboration with the Iraqis. What can you tell us about that?
Well, many of the defendants, not only in the Al Nida trial, but in a number of the other collaborator trials as well, have attempted to repudiate confessions that were secured by Kuwaiti police officers through beatings and torture. And fortunately, a number of the defendants have felt free enough to complain to the judicial tribunal about this torture and thus to attempt to disown the confession. It's not entirely clear to what extent the judges will accept their statements or will rely on the confessions that were secured by police authorities. I, outside of the trials, was able to speak with a number of Palestinians and others who had been arrested by the police and who had suffered very much the same sort of torture that the defendants on trial are complaining of. For example, I interviewed three Palestinian and one Iraqi youths who, in mid-May, were arrested at a checkpoint, and checkpoints are rather pervasive at this stage in Kuwait. They were brought to a local police station, the Sabah al-Salam police station, and put through an ordeal that appeared to have become entirely routinized in that the police officers present actually had names for each of the different torture chambers. There was a party room, a barbecue room, a drinking juice room, and in each room, the victims were forced to submit to tortures appropriate to that room, ranging from beatings with sticks and clubs to electric shock therapy and having cigarettes put out on their skin, to in the drinking juice room being forced to drink what seemed to them to be sewage water. Throughout all of this, the police officers would yell questions at them that were vaguely designed to elicit possible collaboration under the occupation, but in fact seemed more designed simply to badger them. They would be asked, how many Kuwaiti girls did you rape? How many Kuwaiti officers did you turn into the Iraqis? How many cars did you steal? What were you doing during the occupation? Without any real effort to get answers to these questions, but more as an excuse to have some fun, if one views this as fun, with these unfortunate Palestinians. And I saw them roughly 10 days after they had endured this torture, and they still bore obvious scars from this ordeal.
And you spoke to enough Palestinians who gave you very similar stories for you to feel that you could accept that as corroboration that these stories were true.
Yeah. Unfortunately, this experience is one that is quite common, particularly in the Palestinian community. And in fact, it is so pervasive at this stage that it led me to wonder whether it wasn't part of a design on the part of the Kuwaiti government to seek to gradually encourage those Palestinians who remain in Kuwait to simply leave. Roughly half of the Palestinian community that was there before August 2nd fled in the course of the occupation, and those people are simply not being permitted back into Kuwait at this time. Those who remain are at this stage unemployed. The government has systematically fired them, and many of them are terrified to leave their home for fear of encountering the sort of violence that these four youths met in the police station. The only thing at this stage that keeps many of these Palestinians from simply leaving Kuwait right now is that the Kuwaiti government has not released their pensions, the 1 month's salary per year that they accumulate as they work, and which is really a nest egg for retirement or for some future life in another country. And if they were able to receive that as well as to obtain permission to travel by land through Saudi Arabia to Jordan so that they could bring their furnishings and belongings with them, it's quite clear that a substantial percentage of the Palestinian community that remains in Kuwait would flee quite quickly, despite the fact that they were all very happy in Kuwait earlier and had quite a decent life until the Iraqi occupation.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ken Roth. He's deputy director of Human Rights Watch, and he just returned to the United States Tuesday after spending 9 days in Kuwait. He'll testify before Congress this Tuesday. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Ken Roth is my guest, deputy director of Human Rights Watch, and we're talking about his recent trip to Kuwait. A lot of people speculated that when the war was over, Kuwaiti citizens would try to push out people who were residents of Kuwait but not citizens of the country, because so many of those residents who aren't citizens, people known as Bedouins, had been accused of collaborating with the Iraqis. Do you see other evidence of that, of Kuwaitis trying to push out people who they are now suspicious of?
The Kuwaiti government has quite openly talked about the need to restructure their population. And these efforts have been aimed principally at Arab non-Kuwaitis. There are many Filipinos and Sri Lankans who are gradually being welcomed back, but they're not perceived as the same sort of threat as the Palestinian, the Iraqi, and the so-called Bedouin community within Kuwait, all of whom are accused, in many instances falsely, of having cooperated with the Iraqi authorities. The Bedouins are an interesting problem because whereas many of the Palestinians have Jordanian nationality and at least have another place to go, and obviously many of the long-term Iraqi residents of Kuwait could reluctantly return to Iraq if need be. The Bedouin are stateless people. The word Bedouin in Arabic means without, without nationality. And these are, for the most part, of Bedouin origin. They were nomads. And in 1959, when it became possible to register as a Kuwaiti citizen, many of these more nomadic residents of Kuwait simply didn't bother. The lines were long. It cost a little bit of money. It wasn't clear what the purpose of being a citizen was in any event. And their descendants today are now stuck in this permanent status of inferiority. Even before the invasion, it had been possible for Bedouin to work only in the police and the military. And in essence, they were used as an underclass to cheaply fill the rank and file of the armed forces in positions where Kuwaitis would not want to serve. Many of them served Kuwait quite loyally. In fact, I heard many stories of Bedouin soldiers who were taken as POWs after having fought the Iraqis and spent the entire occupation period in Iraqi prisons. A number of them lost their lives. And they are quite shocked, those who survived, to return to Kuwait and find not only have they lost their jobs, but in many instances, if their families, for example, happened to have gone to Iraq looking for them, the families are now not being permitted back in, even though the formal POWs have been let back into Kuwait.
Let me get back to the trials that you observed. The case that has gotten the most attention, as far as I know, here in the United States, was the case of the man who was found guilty of wearing a Saddam Hussein T-shirt and sentenced 15 years for the offense. Was that trial atypical or typical of what's happening now?
Well, that trial was atypical in the sense that it was the first set of trials. And on that day, there were 22 defendants who were tried, if you can call it that, in the course of 55 minutes, 2.5 minutes per defendant. That was obviously a joke, and nobody could explain to me adequately why it is that the court went through that that charade. Fortunately, that has not been replicated since then. The Saddam Hussein T-shirt case itself was the subject of a revised opinion that the court issued while I was in Kuwait. A number of Kuwaiti officials have stressed in public statements that, in fact, this man was not convicted simply for having worn a T-shirt, but in fact, he was somebody who consorted with the Iraqis, collaborated with them, gave them information and the like. And this revised 3-page single-spaced opinion attempts to set forth the other evidence against this man beyond simply wearing the T-shirt. In fact, when you read it, it's filled with all sorts of generalizations about other kinds of collaboration and informing, but nothing specific. And it goes on at considerable length about the fact that the wearing of this T-shirt demoralized the Kuwaiti population. And I felt, reading this thing, that what was really going on was precisely what everybody says has been going on, that this man got 15 years for wearing the T-shirt.
Is there a double standard, do you think, in the trials going on now between how Kuwaitis are being dealt with and non-Kuwaiti citizens, how they're being dealt with?
On the one hand, there is a double standard where there shouldn't be, but there's also not a double standard where there should be. Let me explain. There are very few Kuwaiti citizens who are on trial. Most of the people being tried are Iraqis or Palestinians or Bedouin. Now, it may be that it was only these non-Kuwaiti residents of Kuwait who collaborated with the Iraqi authorities, but I somehow doubt that. For example, there was one case in which a man was accused of having repaired an Iraqi jeep that was brought into his car repair facility. The man who was on trial was a non-Kuwaiti national, but the owner of the facility was a Kuwaiti, and he had not been brought to trial. So that suggests a certain double standard that it's too early to say whether it's a pattern, but it's at least disturbing insofar as we've been able to observe. The flip side is that there has not been any obvious sensitivity to what should be a double standard, and that is the different degrees of resistance that Kuwaitis versus non-Kuwaiti nationals or non-Kuwaiti residents of Kuwait should be expected to offer to the occupying authorities. It's important to remember that the Kuwaiti government was in exile at the time, and to insist that a Bedouin or a Palestinian or an Iraqi resist really to the point of possibly risking torture or death when it's not clear that the Kuwaiti government is ever going to be able to come back to Kuwait, and for all these people know they're stuck living with the Iraqis for the rest of their lives, it's quite unfair to insist that these non-Kuwaiti citizens mount the same sort of resistance as a Kuwaiti citizen who can be expected to have an ongoing duty of loyalty or duty of allegiance to the Kuwaiti government even when it is in exile.
On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk more with Ken Roth about human rights in post-war Kuwait. Roth is Deputy Director of Human Rights Watch. This is Fresh Air.